I think we're all right. Good.
Nobody's supposed to catch that. Spinach.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right, I'm ready to go. Even if we only understand the universe intellectually, it's still quite a wonderful thing. As usual, this is going to be much more philosophy than it is astrology. The universal spirit in which the entire evolutionary creation is produced is just one wonder after another. And one of the things about it is that the universal spirit is unified. It has a unity that runs throughout it by nature and throughout the creation in two primary ways. You might say that in the horizontal, that is within any given world or within any given plane of existence, it expresses its unity in the principle of cause and consequence. This means that a cause and a consequence that issues from it are both two parts of the same event, of the same spirit, seen from two different points of view, with an action in between them producing that change in point of view. So this means that all of our deeds are very meaningful, and they can be understood by the original intent and the final effect, and that's really important. It is a way to understand what comes from the unconscious part of the universal spirit into manifest being, because the spirit, even though it is eternal and it is boundless and everything that is, it is all part of it is also everything that isn't. And when things are brought into the realm of consequences through deeds and actions, the universal spirit looks back upon its creations. And it can do just as it is said in the book of Genesis. They looked back and it was good. They said it was good. The in the vertical, if you want to call it that, there is another kind of unity. The higher and more antecedent realms of consciousness have their own causality. And the different worlds, the different realms, and the different things and beings that inhabit them are consequences of the vertical causality caused from the higher states of spirit until one reaches all the way back into the pure universal spirit itself. But the spirit does not lose its unity, even in the most so-called distant realm of materialization. It's still there. It's still present all of the time. It's very much like Max Heindel used to like to say, God is closer than hands and feet, meaning to say that the spiritual presence is right here, right now, and even though it may not always be palpable, it is there. There is the principle through which we understand the unity of the spirit in the vertical, as opposed to the horizontal, where it is cause and consequence, is the principle of analogy. And the principle of analogy is known in the Hermetic axiom, which was stated by a classical alchemist, as above, so below, what has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. Know this and rejoice. So the unity, we know it's one thing because it manifests itself analogously on all of the different levels, even though it may seem like it's going through a chain of command to do so. Now, this vertical analogy is much more than saying an atom is shaped like a solar system and such and so on. This analogy takes in character. It takes in the feel or the inner nature of the universal spirit all the way through, from the most unified spiritual state to the most differentiated material state. So it's something that we should always have great gratitude for, because I don't think we should know this and rejoice. I think we should know this and give thanks, because we're never really lost. Even in the most minute kind of expression in the creation, we can find the unity of the One in some way that is completely analogous. Now, astrology, not just horoscopy, but full astrology, is something that is, at least from our point of view, because we are in darkness, we're blinded by our materialism, we have been thrown out of the Garden of Eden, and we can no longer see the spiritual worlds, at least until we do the work to be able to regain that capacity. But so for us, astrology is a symbolic vehicle. And it must be obvious that if astrology is to be anything like what it represents, it must be like that also. It must have cause and consequence in it, and it must have analogy in it, and it should work all the way through. Now, some spiritual writers have talked about the principle of analogy in different ways. One of my favorites is everything is in everything. Everything is in everything. That if you know one thing, or if you put the full bore of your consciousness on anything, it will get you to everything, because everything is in everything else, because that is the nature of the universal spirit. It doesn't deny its being to any of the creations within it. It is there, and it is always there, and it's always present. So if we look at astrology in this way, this means that all of the things of astrology are in all of the other things of astrology. And to do that, one sets up a very complex symbol of the universe. As an example, if we know something about the signs, the houses are analogous to the signs. So therefore there's something where the sixth house is something like the sixth sign. The houses deal with the mundane opportunities, whereas the signs deal with the inner flavors and qualities of things. Similarly, if we know something about the planets, we know something about the signs, because the signs are ruled by the planets and the planets are ruled by the signs, and knowing one automatically gives you access to the other. And you can see obviously immediately that the houses are also to be found in the planets. That is to say that if each planet is a specialist of some kind or another, like Mercury is a specialist in mind, And it is as though there were a spiritual being whose whole being was mind. So that if you understand that, it's suited to certain kinds of opportunities and unsuited for other kinds of opportunities. You don't find somebody who has mathematical acumen, you don't have them be the ditch digger. On the other hand, you don't have have an artist try to calculate your horoscope, at least if you want one that's accurate anyway. You might get a pretty one, but beyond that, we don't know. So this is, if this is true for all of the other primary elements of astrology, we're saying that there are four primary elements in astrology. There are signs, which are fields of attitude. An attitude of I can, or an attitude of I can't, or maybe I can. There are some of those signs that tend toward more toward not being able to make up their mind. And if houses represent fields of opportunities, that is, the opportunity to do something in the world, like make money, which would be like the second house, or to lose money, which would be like the eighth house. Some people are born into this world actually to lose money. If you can't keep getting bigger and bigger all the time without getting rid of something, you know. The universe is especially efficient. It digests everything and it hangs on to nothing that is unnecessary. So, but at any rate, the houses represent fields of opportunities. And the planets represent the activators. They represent what focuses the attitudes into the forms. That is, they focus the signs into the houses. And they are the ones who bring things about. But when they do things, and when they bring things about, they do so using the aspects. Finally, we're getting to the aspects that we're talking about. So that the aspects, which is the fourth element, are like the tools. They're the means of doing things. They are modes of activity. And so therefore, they must also be capable of being understood in one symbol. Now, the symbol for the entire cosmos is the astrological mandala. A mandala is a kind of spiritual symbol that comes out from the inner consciousness of someone to represent externally, even if incompletely, what is an experience is inwardly. The simplest kind of mandala is a circle. And some people in some parts of the world express their understanding of the spirit through the circle, and they know how to do it exactly. They'll go out into the plain somewhere and they will form a circle, and they will dance around and around in that circle, and that circle will be as accurate as if you had used a compass to draw that circle. And they'll actually wear all of the vegetation off, and it'll be a rut in a perfect circle, and that's the simplest kind of mandala. This is a very complex kind of mandala. And in a complex mandala, it is supposed to represent everything in the universe as we, as earthbound, spiritually blinded human beings, see the universe. So what we're talking about here is, if we have this symbol and it is true to the universe, if we start thinking about what is represented in the mandala as a symbol, all sorts of things come to us. And they are a vehicle for understanding the world intellectually to give us enough focus so that with that focus, we can tune in on the spiritual truth within the universal spirit, and that is how the mandala is used as a gigantic symbol. Now, in the astrological mandala, everything is put in standard position. This is a very incomplete mandala. There are two more pieces to go on here and maybe more. But you can have the mandala have the constellations. I choose not to do that because that becomes way too complex. But the signs are put in standard order. And the corresponding house, the first house, is put together with the first sign so that they are coincident, so that the signs and houses are in their natural position, and then the mandalic association brings them into a unity. Now, in the mandala, the planets are put in their signs of rulership. That means Mars would be in Aries. It also means that Mars would be in Scorpio, which it co-rules with Pluto. And that means in our symbol that we would have two Mars, which is not the way it is in the heavens, but in the symbolic universe, that's perfectly fine. As you know, last year when we talked about the astrology of the desire body, we said that the basic key word for Mars, for Aries, is self-assertion. And the basic key word for Scorpio is repulsion. And the whole working of the desire world, where one asserts oneself to obtain something, produces a repulsion that pushes everyone else away. And you can see that all of these things are right within the astrological mandala. We would have a Venus in Taurus and in Libra. And Venus is the planet of attraction, whereas Taurus is the sign of attraction. That's the basic key word for it. Libra is the sign of love. It gives love, it forgets itself, it gives its love to its partner. And because it gives its love to its partner, it attracts, as it is in Venus. And so we can see that there are all kinds of things, not only about the physical world, but about all the other spiritual worlds that you can get out of the astrological mandala. And you can actually apply these things. You can find that in a horoscope. You can find that, you have to do a little more than what we just said, but you can find that there is a quotient of repulsion in a given horoscope and how that repulsion is likely to be used. We're going to talk about that tonight, only in a totally unastrological way. We're going to talk about repulsion after death. And so, yeah, I got to give previews of coming attractions. It's my hook to keep people coming back. So, what we're looking at in this universal symbol, we don't see any aspects in it. Now, we can put aspects on. One way would be by brute force. We could just put a big square right from the middle of Taurus to the middle of Leo to the middle of Scorpio and to the middle of Aquarius. And then we could say that the square was associated with those signs. That's, it would be a brute force simple way. And that has been done and has been done for tens of thousands of years. One of the oldest known zodiacs is the Four Corners Zodiac, and that goes back to the Persians, and that was right in the middle of those signs of the zodiac, and because there are bright fixed stars right at those spots. In Taurus, it's Aldebaran, and in Leo, it is Regulus, in Scorpio, it is Antares, and it is Fomalhaut in Aquarius. And it's naturally there. You can just look up in the heavens, and you can see the four corners of a square. That's not the way we're going to do it. We want to be more invisible than that. We want to become spiritual people, and to become spiritual people, we have to become much more subtle. We have to look more for the implicit rather than the explicit. If we look, too many people look explicitly at each other. I like to ogle pretty ladies, and that's a way of looking at them explicitly, and it's taken a long time for me to see their implicit beauty. Beauty's only skin deep. I never got beyond the surface. Unfortunately, these days I don't scratch the surface. looking to find the aspects in the mandala because they aren't obviously there. all kinds of funny things come to mind. Now, what we've been saying is that in the lunation cycle, yesterday we looked at it physically, as if we had taken 29 days and had looked in the heavens and day by day watched the sun, the moon as it changed size and shape and its position relative to the rising or setting of the sun. And now what we're trying to do, another thing that we said yesterday, is that within the lunation cycle, that there are pairs of aspects, a conjunction at the beginning of the cycle and a conjunction at the end of the cycle, a sextile at the beginning and a sextile at the end, a square at the beginning and a square in the second half, a trine in the first half and a trine in the second half, and the opposition leading up to the full moon is a first opposition, and after the full moon is a second opposition. We're saying that each of the aspects, but especially the conjunction and opposition, represent changes of attitude, changes of activity, and changes of state within the cycle of the cosmos where everything is accomplished. At least everything on Earth is accomplished through the lunation cycle. And we're calling that cycle the cycle of accomplishment. Now, so what we want to do is we want to find now how the aspects are implicitly in the zodiac. Well, what we can do is we can superimpose the lunation cycle onto the mandala. And if we superimpose the lunation cycle onto the mandala, then the aspects automatically fall out. All of the aspects are basically divisible by 30 degrees, and there are even some minor aspects that are also divisible by 30 degrees, so that all of the aspects are implicitly within the cusps of the signs and houses. And this opens up all kinds of things. This means that a sign and a house that is square to another sign and house, it tells us something about life. My favorite example is the 11th house, which is the house of friendship. And the house of friendship is square to the house of money gained or money lost. And it fits perfectly to an adage that has been around for many centuries. My mother wasn't that kind of a person, but I've heard it from a lot of other people. If you want to lose a friend, lend them money. Would somebody go pull the plug on the phone, please? It's right on the back of the phone body itself. Just pull the plug off. So we can understand all kinds of things about life and interactions with other people by looking at the relationships of one house to another geometrically. But we're looking for the standard model. Now, in the standard model, the circle has a beginning. We say the beginning is at the first degree of Aries, or the beginning of the first house. Therefore, everything, Aries is sort of like the Big Bang of the mandala. You have to do something. And when you have to do something, you put forth effort, which is what Aries loves to do. It's one of those signs that loves to sweat. No comments. Therefore, the cusp of Aries is the first cusp of everything. It's the cusp's cusp. Now, in the aspects, the first aspect is the aspect's aspect. It is the conjunction. And therefore, if we put the aspect on the cusp, we then have an understanding of the lunation cycle that helps us to understand the mandala, and we have something of the mandala that helps us to understand the lunation cycle. Because remember, in all of this, we're trying to get a feel for any cycle at all, but we're doing it through the lunation cycle, and if we have a feel for this, we can live our lives more efficiently. Except that the world hates astrology, because the world, you know, in our human world, you got times that you have to keep. And that's good that we're ordered and that we're efficient and things like that, but our time is not the same as God's time. And therefore, our time, when you have to, there's nothing that says you have to be there at 8 in the morning in God's time. It's true that if you live an agricultural life and you wake up with the sun, you don't have any artificial light like this, then you are on God's time. But we're terribly artificial. We've gotten quite far removed. But at any rate, the aspects represent interactions between two planets, or between a planet and a point, or between a point and a point, and you can get pretty complex about it. And that means that any aspect is some form of a conjunction. And if there is no aspect, it's called an inconjunct, meaning to say no real aspect. Now, this idea goes very far back in astrology. It goes back to India. A few things go back to India, but not everything. And in India, the aspect activity is called yoga, as in our word yoga, as we pronounce it in the West. And if I pronounce it that way, Sharaji cringes right away. But if I say yoga, and it means union. It's where our word yoke, where you talk about a team of oxen are yoked together. Or like in that famous statement which somebody told me after my divorce went through and I was totally disconsolate, they said, "Be ye not unequally yoked." Fortunately, they were kind enough to not to say who was not the junior member. Yes. And so there are different kinds of yogas. And when we think of the word yoga, we think about postures and breathing and things like that. But what it really means is a connection. Like two oxen are connected together, they're yoked together. And in a state of yoga, a being is connected together or is in union with the divine. Or in the case of aspects, two planets are yoked together in such a way that something comes out of it. All right, now I'm completely away from my notes and I can't find my way back because... I can't read, I can't see. And it's not because of the light, it's because of me. All right, let's reproduce the lunation cycle as though it were on the mandala. Again, we're assuming that the sun is fixed throughout all of this. So, this would be the second conjunction. This would be the first. And if we come down to the third house, this would be the first sextile. Or up to the 11th house, that would be the second sextile. The first square would bring us down to the cusp of the fourth house. Or up to the 10th house. First trine would bring us to the fifth house. That's a little bit too ambitious there. And And the first opposition would be everything up to the full moon. And the second opposition would be everything, trying to do something with both sides of the brain at the same time. It doesn't work so well. All right. This is what we're going to use to try for the rest of the week as we look at the pairs of aspects that we have been following, that we're saying represent major turning points in the whole business. The opposition, again, we see is like the conjunction, and they're both different in that the opposition and conjunction are it's the same aspect, that is first and second. But the first and second parts of that same aspect are radically different from each other, and we'll be talking more about that again on Friday when we get to the last aspect. Now, taking this and putting it on here, on the astrological mandala, and pondering that with any problem that you have to ponder astrologically, I have never had it happen that I have tried to ponder on the astrological mandala that it hasn't given me oodles and oodles and oodles of information and understanding about the nature of the cosmos. It is something that is rich. It is like pure light. Like if you need to know anything about life, or if you need to know anything about the universe, just look at the mandala and start thinking, and everything just flows and it comes open very easily to you. It is sort of an open sesame. I'm going to have to read all of my notes about 15 minutes before the talks, because otherwise I'm not going to be able to use the notes even as memories. What we're talking about today are the first and second sextiles. That is, if the sun stays fixed at the ascendant, we're talking about aspects to the third house and to the 11th house. Now, the examples that we're going to use today are not, because what happens is that of all the aspects that we study that are out here, the sextiles are the most mild. Some people use much smaller orbs for the sextiles. I find myself doing that a lot because each of the sextiles is not, you know, if everything else is equal, a sextile will always be weaker than a square. And if everything else is equal, a sextile will always be weaker than a conjunction. And so we have to, the horoscopes that we have are not the best. They're not quite as obvious as what we had yesterday, a little bit more subtle. Now, when we look at horoscopes, again, we're not looking at everything in the horoscopes. We're looking only at the sun and moon. And that may not be the most important thing, and certainly not the only thing. And the way we're going to look at them is not the only way you can look at them. We're only looking at them, again, to get the feel of things. You can see that if you think about the activity of the recording angels, you can't think about it exactly the way that we do things in this world, but every thought and every emotion that we have has to have its recompense. Cause and consequence is right down to the smallest detail. And if there were only one way that you could bring something about, the recording angels would have a very hard time bringing somebody to birth and getting them to be able to work out their destiny. There are many ways that the same thing can be accomplished. We saw that yesterday when we speculated whether Salvador Dali was the younger brother of his that died at age one. We saw that the flavor of the sun and moon in the two charts was similar. It wasn't identical, it was similar. And so this is one of the things for astrology. You know, it's especially one of those things when you try to, I don't know how to get it, I guess you'd say play astrology or play destiny, where you try to figure out what's going to happen to you so you can avoid it. I've tried that a few times in life. That would be Gnostic astrology. The Gnostics studied astrology to see what the gods were up to, and then they tried to do just the opposite thing because they felt that was the only way, that they were free people, and they thought the gods were very imperfect anyhow. And that's the attitude they had about astrology. But if you try to play astrology in ex post facto, you can do that. You can look back and you can say, wow, that's just the way it is. I had that happen this summer. I had a lot of problems with my eye. And after it had happened to me, I looked back and it's a textbook example of how to have trouble with your eye. But beforehand, I didn't see it. I was thinking about it in terms of other things because I had other things going on in my life at that time. And so I thought, these things are going to happen, but it doesn't work out that way. The events can be brought to you many different ways, but when they're brought to you, they're brought to you exactly right. We would try to tabulate things, you know, like we try to keep score. Well, this thought was like this, and this thought, you know, look, we think of the recording angels of having big adding machines or something like that, and they're clicking the data in. I don't think it quite works that way. I think that it's more like chaos mathematics, where there are forms that we set up, and then we produce all of these different thoughts and desires and such, and they migrate to certain forms because that's where our consciousness is. Either that or they emanate from those forms until there is enough energy bound up in them that it produces an event. And the timing of that event turns out to be exactly right. I think that's a little better kind of a picture than to think that it's like, you know, stepping on the rake and getting bopped in the head. The cause and consequence doesn't work exactly that way. All right. What we're trying to look at here is my notes, which I can't read at all. Oh, boy. I am going to do something that he's not going to like. I'm going to turn on a little more light. I'm sorry that it doesn't work out right for you, Jerry, but I just can't, you know. Yesterday, when we were talking about conjunctions, we talked about how sprouts came out of the ground and how they were not easy to differentiate one from another. And we said that at the beginning of a cycle, it was like that. The energy is, you know, you don't know what it's going to be like when you start a project. If you're going to write a poem or you're going to build a house or something like that, you don't know what it's going to be like when you start out. You've got a picture in your mind, but the picture in your mind doesn't always work with the external reality. And so the undifferentiated energy at the beginning of the cycle is just like that. The conjunction has that quality. Two planets are brought so much together that it's hard to separate their influences. It's like an alloy, where things get melded together so well that they produce a substance that's not like either the two metals that went into the alloy in the first place. Similarly, the conjunction at the end of the cycle is like that too. You've undone everything. You've looked through everything. You've analyzed everything. And now all you want to do is go back home. The differences don't make any difference anymore. Just let me get back home. And that's sort of the undifferentiated energy of the conjunction, first and second. The sextile, we're going to look first at the first sextile and then at the second sextile. The third house is the house of elementary education. And when you start out a project and you learn a few things and you gather your tools together and you start using them, that's what it's like. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily that because it is something new and something elementary that it is bad. There are little children that can write very good poems with very elementary tools and techniques. So this is what the first sextile is like. It's elementary. But there's an attitude about it. And that attitude is such that you're relaxed. The sextiles in general have a Jupiter rulership, which means that they're expansive, that they're abstract, that they're reflective, and they are relaxed. And you know how it is. If you're, you don't know the when you begin something, you don't know how complex it really is. You don't at all know how complex it is. But you go out there and you've got confidence and you've got your tools and you can do things that surprise everyone. Little children are like that. All the complexities they're not aware of yet, but they can do surprisingly good things because all of the complexities haven't been born to their character. And so this is the attitude of what the first sextile is like. It says, let me try this, and it works. And it works very well. And there's a destiny like that. There's a destiny that you would call, I call it beginner's luck. It really isn't luck, but it's the sort of thing that you have a benefic experience, and you have that benefic experience because you are a beginner. And this doesn't mean that it is untrue, because when you get into all of the complexities of things, and when you've struggled for a long time to hold the structure of something together in order that you can experience through it, you become fixed in your ways. And the complexities hide a lot of things. So that sometimes a newcomer comes in, and that newcomer can see things that the old-timers never saw. They're blind to them. And so this is the attitude of the first sextile. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at a few charts with first sextile, beginner's luck sextile. And when we do that, we have to remember that when you work with astrology, you sometimes have to work with people that you don't like. And you sometimes have to work with people that are very hard to work with. And if you work at it and if you pray, I do a lot of praying. People think I'm pondering the cosmos and things like that. They give me a horoscope and I look and I look and I look, and 45 minutes later, they're going out for water or something like that. And they say, he must be pondering deep things. So very often I'm praying because you have to have astrological insight. That's the only way you can get it. But if you try to love someone, there is that famous experiment that was done. I have a friend that is a dean of a college of social work. And she developed her skills through being a psychiatric social worker. And she had all of these researches that she found that were fascinating. And they found using all different kinds of ages, genders, schools of psychology, and things like that, when there was a successful therapy between a psychologist or a psychiatrist that was agreed upon as being successful by both the agent and the patient, when they did all these massive studies of all the different factors, they found out only one factor that was consistent throughout all of them, and that was if the therapist liked the patient, there was more likely to be success. It wasn't 100% success. I find out that there are some people that are meant to be people for you. There's some people you can look at a horoscope, you can look at it hour after hour and hour, and nothing comes. And then some people you just take a glance and it's all there and it's clear and it comes out. All right, but what we're trying to say here is that some people are we do not like. And when we look at famous people, we're going to look at a few famous people that we don't like. We have to love them anyway, and we have to try to understand them anyway, because the universe would be incomplete if they weren't there, and they have something to offer, even though it may not seem so to us. I'm not above taking cheap shots, and I may take a few cheap shots as some of these horoscopes, or the owners of some of these horoscopes. If this gets too outrageous, just let me know, and I'll try to rein myself in a little bit because of that. All right, let's look at elementary horoscopes. Again, I only did a dozen, and so you're going to have to share with each other. Sharesies is fairesies, as we would say when we were kids. The first four horoscopes that we're going to look at are, we're going to look at them very, very briefly, because we're looking at 13 horoscopes today, because we're going to look at them extremely briefly because there's not that much time. They're all beginner's luck horoscopes. And the first four are chosen because they are people who had an enormous amount of success, but their success in life was not commensurate with their skills and ability. There are some people that they're just right because they are beginners, and the world likes them, because if they were more advanced, it would be too much for the people, and they would not be able to, you know, they would not be able to understand them. They're from four different generations. Judy Canova is from the radio era, and she was someone who everybody loved. She took on the persona of being a hillbilly, and she was a very endearing kind of person. In this case, the sun is in Sagittarius, and they are the most amiable types of people of all, usually. I run into very few Sagittarians that are disliked. And you can't even butter them up with that saying that they're disliked. This is a horoscope that's very classic for what we're trying to get at. The sun is conjoined Mercury in the 12th house, and the first sextile is to the moon in the second house. And she became very, very wealthy. And she became very wealthy because of her Sagittarian nature and because she kept things simple. And she had a rambunctious type of personality. Mars in the first house is, it's highly spirited. And that's what she was known as. A highly spirited kind of person that played a hillbilly and did it in a goofy sort of way. Sagittarius is always willing to be the happy clown for everyone else, and it's quite interesting. In fact, actually, she had parts of her that weren't so happy. She may have been even a manic depressive, because the moon is opposite to the conjunction of Saturn and Neptune. This bipolar people very often have that. Sagittarius, I find, has more bipolarity than any other sign, because they're probably the most extroverted of all the signs, and they're capable of exhaustion. And there's a kind of bipolar thing that a person rides with the energy until it's all gone, and then when it's all gone, they collapse. And because they've identified with the energy, then there's no energy there, they go into a dark, deep depression. But she did this all by just being loved for being a hillbilly. And so she had beginner's luck. She wasn't any great talent. She could sing. I think her most famous song that was noted for, what was it? One night I made a slip and shot the sheriff in the hip. And when he complained, this is what I said, I didn't know the gun was loaded. I'm so sorry, my friend. I didn't know the gun was loaded, and I'll never, ever do it again. All right, let's... luckily, it's not a talent contest. Will Chamberlain is the next one. Will Chamberlain is in the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. And he was the first
of the giants. The first that was over 7 feet tall. I think he was 7'2" or something like that. And he had a little bit of talent. It wasn't like Larry Bird, or it wasn't like Magic Johnson or anything like that. He didn't have a whole lot, but he had size. And what he did is he perfected a few techniques. And with those few techniques, he was unstoppable, size and a few simple techniques. And that's what this horoscope looks exactly like. The moon is in the sixth house, which represents technique, and he was able to carry that all off. I don't know what more to say about him. He had some other techniques, too. He claimed in his autobiography that he had copulated with 10,000 women in his life, literally 10,000 of them. And that kind of emotional excess is what you expect when you see Venus square Jupiter. It isn't necessarily the most sexual, but it's the most excessive, and it gets so relaxed that it has no standards. And my apologies to all the people who have Jupiter-Venus afflictions. I don't mean to say that you're all like that. The third person is another person of minimal talent. He's a very famous and influential man. He's a right-wing talk show, and all he does is talk. And the talk doesn't have very much content to it. It is his particular kind of minimalism. Yeah. His minimalism happens to be stupidity. He's got Saturn square Mercury is what I'm talking about. And Saturn square Mercury is the planet. They're both planets are retrograde, which means that he doesn't believe in evolution, but he's a proof for devolution. And that's one of the things. Saturn square Mercury is a darkened mind, and it's the kind of mind that tries to do things in a dark way that could be done very simply if you were just out in the open. Like people will, to make money, they'll spend many more hours than if they went to work and earned the money. They'll spend many more hours trying to figure out a crime in order a way to do it. And just recently, Rush Limbaugh was busted for having somebody else's prescription to Viagra. And it would have been no problem at all if he had just went to a doctor and said, give me a prescription for Viagra. I'm going to Santo Domingo, and I want to meet the ladies there. But because he tried to take the dark route, he got caught. I haven't heard his alibi for it yet, because I can't stand to listen to him more than 5 minutes at a time. But, you know, like he tried to have an alibi also for his drug addiction, which is the Sun square Neptune. But we're looking at the Sun sextile Moon. What we're seeing here is somebody that has a talent. It isn't a talent for political analysis. People that he doesn't like, he mocks. He'll take someone that is of a different political disposition, and he will play recordings of something they've said, and he'll say it's all gobbledygook. And it isn't gobbledygook. The person is actually saying somebody, but because it isn't something he likes, because he knows that he's appealing to many people that are not highly intelligent. And you can't challenge him. The screeners, if you try to get through those screeners to talk to him and question him on some things, you'll never do it. He always has people that are in his camp supporting him for what he does. So the only reason the horoscope is here is it's another generation of somebody who is relaxed, has a beginning understanding of something, and has a ripe destiny to make a lot of money from it and to become quite popular. Again, the current goes from the Sun in the 12th house, which is ripe destiny. It goes to the sextile of the Moon in the second house, so he can consolidate that ripe destiny into all kinds of wealth. And the fourth and the last one of the beginner's luck people is somebody who also is not particularly talented, but she's fabulously wealthy. It isn't that she doesn't have talent. Yeah. It isn't that she doesn't have talent. It's just that it's not highly developed and it's not highly sophisticated. And it's like a beginner's luck thing. Her whole life is a beginner's luck quality. It has that feel to it. That's why these examples are given. She knows how to communicate to some extent, both communicate and express. In this case, the sun is in the third house, which is the house of communication, and the moon is in the fifth house, which is the house of expression. And so even though herself, she's not really an out in the world kind of person, in some way she's even awkward a little bit as far as being a celebrity. She makes quite a few blunders. She drops the ball quite a bit, especially the baby. She drops quite a bit. She's had a few incidents of driving the car with one hand and the baby with the other, and she dropped the baby, and now she has a personal bodyguard that carries the baby anywhere she goes. All right. Let's look at the next horoscope, which is, has something a little bit more to it. This is not a beginner's luck. This is anything but beginner's luck. This is somebody that is a very old soul. We know this person in the news as the Dalai Lama. And what he is doing is not a beginner's luck activity. Sometimes we have developed something from the past, and when we have developed it, we have to expand. The sextile is a reflective aspect, and sometimes you reflect from one thing to another thing. Like a musician might study acoustics, and from acoustics they might study color for the tones of sound versus the tones of color, things like that. In effect, this is a man that is redoing. He's giving a rebirth, a new rebirth of Tibetan Buddhism. It couldn't come under a conjunction, which would be the beginning of a rebirth, because it would be unformulated. But because it is a sextile, it can be expanded and it can be reformulated and it can be brought out into the world in that, how do they say, new and improved way. Let's look at one more horoscope.
The sextile, were we talking about for the Dalai Lama?
The sun in Cancer sextile, the moon in Virgo.
Okay.
The next horoscope is somebody who looked at Christianity different than anyone before him in history. When we came from our European roots, their Catholicism was very formalized. It had gone through quite a few centuries of formalization and it was quite concretized. If the Protestant religions, like Lutheranism and other Germanic kinds of Christianity, were very orthodox and they were very fixed in one way or another. And even things like the Puritans, who tried to have a really simple religion, it was still, they had an orthodox thing. What we're looking at here with Ralph Waldo Emerson is the first of the Unitarians. He didn't go around knocking on people's doors, but he did go around giving a lot of lectures. He Americanized Christianity. And in that Americanization, he reformulated it. He also took a lot of classical ideas and transcendental ideas going all the way back to India, and he reformulated them. But the people of India wouldn't recognize it either, because he was Ralph Waldo Emerson was what might be called the first of the pragmatic Christians. Not pragmatic necessarily only in a physical and mechanical way, but that it was practical for your state of living, Not that you had to feel like you lived in woe because you were in a state of sin or something like that. You know, his thought was that Christianity could give you a better way of living. It was a philosophical Christianity, and it was very much for the United States. And that's what that second, first sextile between the sun and moon from the 8th to the 10th houses. If let's go look back at the Dalai Lama for a second. He has most of his planets beneath the Earth. So he doesn't like all of the public activity that he has to do. And he especially does not like all the political work that he has to do. That's something that he must bear on him terribly heavily. But it's because Saturn is in the 10th house, and wherever Saturn is, that's a heavy, hard situation. It comes with a trine to the sun, and it is because he bears that cross that he has some deeper insights and enlightenments, but he's not happy with it all. In fact, I happen to like the man very much because he really, really is cheery, happy. And I love the, if you see him when he's giving a talk and his monks are there, the translator will be translating a real long sentence that he's done. He's monkey-facing it and smiling with the monks, and you can see that it's a joyous, happy way. But it's not without sorrow, because he has that same Moon, Neptune, Saturn opposition that indicates depressiveness. Fortunately, he has a lot of meditation practice behind him. Oh, you know, you folks might have one. Oh, here I have. We're now at the horoscope of Maria Montessori, which is the last one we're going to look at for the first sextile. Maria Montessori was one of the educators who reformatted education. And the reformatting in this is really excellent, because Montessori education focuses on sensory experience. It goes back to the woman who was with Helen Keller. What was her name? Anne Sullivan. And that whole idea that through sensory experience is the way to educate children. And Virgo is a touchy-feely sign. The sun is there in the second house. It means very, you know, like you have touch, feel circumstances with the physical world, and then it reflects forward to the moon in the fourth house, which is the personal subconscious. It reflects forward and it formulates in the personal subconscious the inner experiences that are later going to form the personality. But this is, again, somebody who isn't known necessarily as a founder, like yesterday when we looked at Ho Chi Minh or Max Heindel or any of those charts. This is somebody who is a reformulator, and the reformulation work is much more important than the any founding that comes out of it. All right, now let's look at the second sextile horoscopes and the quality of the second sextile. The second sextile happens after the second square, but it happens before the second conjunction. And in the second square, the pillars have been pulled out, and all the bricks have fallen to the ground. And in falling, they've all been separated. Everything has been disintegrated. It has been broken into its individual parts. And so the second sextile is like taking all of these pieces, all these bricks, and saying, well, what can I make of this? Or it's like taking a little bit of the walls off of a brick building and seeing what the structure was behind those walls. Even more than that, it is like synthesizing the basic elements, the bricks, the mortar, the rivets, the I-beams, and so on. Now, I hope we didn't get the idea that the first sextile is shallow. Doesn't have to be, but it just means that it's superficial, and there's a time that superficiality is necessary. And by the same token, I don't mean to say that the second sextile is necessarily deep, but someone who is capable of synthesizing and understanding relationships that weren't capable of being understood unless one separated everything back to the original elements. That is the kind of consciousness that is necessary to get the most out of the second sextile. And so let's look at some second sextile people. The first one is Lewis Carroll. Very brilliant man, mathematician, logician, poet, and pimper of little children. it's not known that necessarily that he did that. And I don't want to go into that, though it is astrologically possible in this horoscope that he, not necessarily a pedophile, but something of that nature. Sometimes you become so old of a soul that you have lost your innocence. And sometimes when people lose their innocence and they try to regather it back and they are within the shell of materialism so that they can't see things well, they see that lost innocence and purity in little children, and that is the basis for pedophilia. And that is why Jesuits, the middle name of every Jesuit is pedophile. At least that's what a Jesuit told me. And the Jesuits were famous for being lost innocence. They took a vow to do anything to serve the order of Jesus. And that doing anything meant lying, cheating, stealing, murdering, anything. They're famous. Shakespeare writes about them with their doctrine of equivocation, where they'd make a deal with one king in the name of the Pope, and then they'd tell another king what the first one offered, and he'd outbid them, and then they'd go back to the first one and say, well, it went the other way because when we left here, we had an intervening revelation. Yeah, all right. But Lewis Carroll is someone who the second sextile is by far the most synthetic of the two sextiles. And it is a synthesis where different things are put together. Now, if you ever read the poetry of Lewis Carroll, he, like I just said, like when the bricks are all apart and you put them together, that's the way Lewis Carroll treated words. Yes, he had themes, and yes, he had ideas, but he treated words as though they were building blocks, and he would put them together for their sounds or for their rolling quality in them, and he would even try to fudge words together, or to what would be called a psychological contraction. His most famous being chortle, which is a combination of a chuckle and what's the other part of it? I forget. I have a one. I'll give you one of my own. A luniac. It's where you fuse two things together. But this is that kind of consciousness. He compounds things from basic elements that are syntheses of other things. A lot of his logical problems, which after the talk, Shard will enlighten you about, he did solve all kinds of logical problems using techniques similarly. Let's look at Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in his biography, which other philosophers say was written with slavish dislike for the truth, but in his autobiography, he says that he can see all philosophies are one, that he can show anyone that all the different philosophies are the same philosophy. Now, of course, all of the other philosophers, which were partisan to their own schools, thought that this was preposterous, and they could demonstrate logically why their metaphysics was different than another metaphysics, and the two could not possibly be synthesized into one philosophy. But they didn't understand Rousseau. If we look at Rousseau, we find that the sun is in Cancer. And it's a second sextile between the sun and the moon, between the ninth and the tenth house. One of the philosophers of his time, David Hume, took him in when he was in trouble, And his description of Jean-Jacques Rousseau was is if you took a man and pulled off of his all of the skin off of him and put him out into the world, because he was that sensitive. He was that much of a feeler. Cancer is the feeler sign. And what happens if you read very carefully the autobiography of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, what you find out is that he would get the feeling of truth or the feeling of discovery that all of the different philosophers got, and he could see that was the same. It doesn't make any difference whether you discover it through this kind of a logical train or whether you follow history in this way. If you come to a discovery and that discovery feels the same for all people, and that's the kind of synthesis that he did. The moon conjunct Neptune shows somebody who is an extreme feeler, so that this second sextile was a synthesis on the basis of feeling and on the basis of imagination, and not necessarily on the basis of strict logic or something like that. Very quickly looking at the next horoscope. This is a general synthesizer. He synthesized just about everything in his life. He was a commercial artist who became a creative cartoonist at the very time that was coming into vogue. He's a creative man, as indicated by the sun conjoined Uranus. And they're part of that second sextile with the moon. Now, he was known before that and after that as a storyteller. And his cartoons aren't just actions or actions with that have funniness about him. All of his cartoons had to tell stories, and all of his cartoons were episodic, which is what you'd expect for somebody in the third house, a little bit of information in the story and a little bit more of information in the story. Long tails are indicated by Sagittarius. It shows very clearly. It also shows something about him because he was so irresponsible as a creator, at least to begin with. He kept getting himself into trouble, even though he had all these great ideas, and he always had to have his brother come in and help him out. He was fighting City Hall. He has the sun opposite Pluto, which is the aspect of fighting City Hall, and so what he did is he had his brother take care of all of his legal affairs. Later on, he reflected into electronic media. And from there, he reflected into other things until eventually he came right back again when he had his own network. He narrated his own programs. In fact, he was known in his time almost, you know, like Ronald Reagan. He'd come on and show his own show and give all of the information, tell the story and all of that, and very synthetic man, always came right back to the same thing. He's a very general synthesis. Now, the next one is a little bit hard to understand. Hugo Black, considered one of the three most intelligent people to have ever sat on the Supreme Court. I think, in general, it is believed that Oliver Wendell Holmes was the most brilliant person to have ever sat on the Supreme Court. But Hugo Black was no slouch. And he was a synthesis in a very unusual way. He was taken at, you know, the Supreme Court is a very political thing. There always has to be one black, there always has to be one Jew, there always has to be one woman. It's a politically correct statement. You never deviate from that formula. It was a big change when the first woman got onto the Supreme Court. And he used to joke and say that he was the token hillbilly or the token southerner on the Supreme Court. And he played that role, but what he did is he worked much, much more than the justices on his on his decisions. And he tried to work with everything as very fundamental bricks, fundamental building blocks. He took everything right back to the initial pieces, and then he tried to build from there. And his main idea was the idea of inalienable rights that every human being has, and that any issue, any court case, can be taken back to inalienable rights and built forward from there until you come to a wise decision. He was especially known for his decisions, even his dissents, about free speech, which is, again, exactly what we'd expect from the third house. We have so this is somebody that took legal cases and took the elements and synthesized them down to rights and then built his case out of that, or made his judgment out of that. He didn't really build the case, made his judgment on the basis of that. This is the man that was so very, very strong on freedom of the press. And he says the press has been doing what it's supposed to do. It has been exposing things that the executive or the Congress representative branch of the government doesn't want to handle. They expose those things and put them out before the world to see. So this is a very good example, and probably the best example of a synthetic horoscope is the next one. It is the famous composer Béla Bartók. He was even a more radical synthesizer than Lewis Carroll or than Hugo Black. Béla Bartók would start with folk songs, and he would take them further and further back to their fundamental components. He would abstract them, and then he would put those components together, into a composition. So this is the second sextile in this horoscope is between the two most abstract houses, the ninth house, which is open-ended philosophical abstraction, and the 11th house, which is parallelism. The moon is in the sign of Aquarius, which is parallelism. So basically, this is someone then that philosophically abstracted, and a melody, what started out as a folk melody, may stretch over many bars, and the harmony may be delineated also, but it doesn't sound like a harmony anymore. And his music was very jarring, very aggressive, and he took Aries-like themes, Bluebeard's Castle and the Miraculous Mandolin. They're filled with violence and things like that. Like, I don't know that he philosophically believed that the primitive life, where everything is brought down to being like a savage level, I don't know if that was his philosophy or not, but it sure seems to come through in a lot of his music. And let's look at one who is, I don't know how to say it any other way, a pseudo-synthesizer. Because the synthesis isn't always out there like a musical score, or a judicial, writing for the majority or minority. It isn't always out there. Sometimes the synthesis takes place in consciousness. This is someone who, synthesis was one of the favorite words of this person. This is somebody that she was a model at one time. She was a Spanish dancer at one time. She was a specialist in criticism, and she was a rabid psychoanalyst, and she was enormously sexual, having many, many lovers and husbands that stood for it, letting her have all sorts. She's famous for having written pornography, but what she is most famous for, artists just love her. She's most famous for her diaries. She left behind 60 diaries that comprised most of her life. But she had two sets. And one of the sets was duplicitous. It was the false diary. It was what she wanted in her mind. And all through her life, she kept changing, going back and changing her diary, trying to change her past. And being a psychoanalyst, she believed that we synthesize character into something else. There was an inherent contradiction in all of this, because on one hand, being a psychoanalyst, she wanted to go back to the basic building blocks, which she thought were primitive desires. And therefore, the more that you could be like a primitive person in your soul nature, the healthier and happier you would be. But on the other hand, she believed that you could take the elements of your character and through psychoanalysis, you could synthesize yourself and become somebody different, and that you would be psychologically healthier and happier in doing so. And she claimed to do this again and again, and nobody around her saw her actually be synthesized. She hadn't changed. It was all in her mind. And as much as she liked to write about synthesis and speak about synthesis, it never happened. So the you might say that this is an invisible second sextile. And you might expect that with all the things beneath the earth. And there's, you know, with the sun in Pisces, there are plenty of possibilities for self-delusion in all of that. And that's as much as we have for today. And we'll close with the Rosicrucian prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.